The late Hunter S. Thompson, who wrote at least a dozen books, was credited with coining the term gonzo journalism. The term described his own writing. He felt free to insert himself and his opinion in his writing, and that wasn't normally the norm by traditional journalistic standards. Thompson was a political junkie, and he first wrote of a left-behind people motivated only by, quote, an ethic of total retaliation in his novel Hell's Angels, The Strange and Terrible Saga of the Outlaw Motorcycle Gangs. It was published in 1966. Pomona College political scientist Susan McWilliams believes Thompson would have a lot to say about the rise of Donald Trump in our politics. She wrote about it in The Nation, and she joins us now. Susan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you start your article in no place else but Wisconsin at a Trump rally where Trump is mocking Governor Scott Walker by saying he doesn't look like a motorcycle guy. The motorcycle guys, he added, like Trump. Who are these motorcycle guys in Thompson's book of 50 years ago, and what do they have to do with Trump's motorcycle guys?
Well, about 50 years ago, Hunter S. Thompson got sent out by The Nation magazine to look at the phenomenon, the weird phenomenon at the time of motorcycle gangs, and particularly the Hell's Angels. And when Thompson went out to California and spent some time with the Hell's Angels, he decided that what he saw wasn't what most Americans saw when they looked at the Hell's Angels, which was, you know, a band of criminal, sleazy, you know, reprobates. He looked at them and he said he saw the future of American politics, a future that he said America was going to be wholly unprepared to deal with it, with when it really blew up in the way that he thought it would blow up. What Thompson saw in the Hell's Angels in particular were a bunch of guys who were loyal American patriots. A lot of them had fought in World War II, or whose dads had fought in World War II. They were not well educated, but they were strong. They were willing to work, but technological change had happened and had taken most of the jobs that they could do away. And so these were guys who really felt like they'd been left behind in their own society, scorned in their own society. Elites were increasingly mocking even their patriotism and saying that it was too simple-minded in the era of Vietnam. Thompson saw in all of that a kind of emerging political class that, like you say, I think is starting to be fully realized in what we call Trumpism.
And you wrote that Thompson thought one of the chief problems of the left was that there was absolutely no way for them to appeal to this group of disenfranchised Americans because of their dislike of political correctness and all things elite. Is there any way for these groups to meet halfway?
Well, I think Thompson thought it would be really hard. I mean, he was looking at California, and in California at the time, you know, sort of politics on the left was dominated by what he called Berkeley types, you know, elites, intellectuals who liked to think that they really stood for the underdog and the underclass, but didn't really understand the underdog and the underclass and were too busy pronouncing, you know, all of their knowledge to really pay attention to what was going on all around them. I mean, I think part of why he wrote Hell's Angels was to get particularly what we would call coastal elites today to try to think a little bit more seriously about what it was like to be somebody who was left behind, left out, and disgruntled to the point of being so pissed off that they'd rather give the finger to the whole system than even hope that there would be any kind of change.
So there is this element of deplorables, perhaps, that we heard so much during the campaign, a word that came from Hillary Clinton in her campaign.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way that most Americans looked at the Hell's Angels in the 1960s is almost identical to the way that we heard people talk about, elites talk about the deplorables during the campaign and continue to hear them talk about deplorables today. And Thompson thought that was precisely part of the problem, that the more you entrench the idea among the elite that some people are, you know, backwards and somehow beneath contempt, the more you make those people really mad and the more those people become determined to undermine you by any means necessary.
And you drew a lot of intriguing parallels between this, what you said, alienated white masculine working class culture, one that is, quote, fundamentally misunderstood by intellectuals, and of what we are, quote, deplorables of today that we've been talking about. Are the parallels very clear to you, or this was 50 years ago. Do times change?
Well, I mean, of course, some of the specifics change. And one of the reasons that I think it's worth returning to Hell's Angels and to Hunter S. Thompson's writings more broadly is that any time you get a book that was written 50 years ago that feels like it could be written right now, I think that's proof that the writer was really onto something important. And I'll tell you, I don't know if any of your listeners have picked up Hunter S. Thompson or Hell's Angels lately, but when you pick up that book, it feels eerily like the present day. And so I think there are some, you know, minor changes, you know, sort of minor circumstances that have changed. It's hard to understand the Hell's Angels without thinking about Vietnam, the emerging war in Vietnam in particular. But I think those differences in specifics pale in comparison to the similarities in terms of what the basic cultural dynamics were. And I think Thompson would have even said himself, in the 60s, that was really just emerging. Mm-hmm. He says that he's seeing like the first wave of something that's going to be a lot bigger. And so I think it's a lot bigger now, and that is different.
We're talking with politics professor Susan McWilliams about the author Hunter S. Thompson and how he foreshadowed the reality in many ways of our politics and our democracy today. She makes these points about it from his book, Hell's Angels, The Strange and Terrible Saga of the Outlaw Motorcycle Gangs by Hunter S. Thompson. And she writes about that in The Nation. And you can join in this discussion at 800-486-8655. Again, that's 800-486-8655. Susan, tell us more about the writer Hunter S. Thompson. Who was he? What was this gonzo journalism like? And who was this man, Hunter S. Thompson?
Well, Hunter S. Thompson, he was born in the late 1930s, and he grew up in Kentucky, a kind of middle-class family. He was a, you know, bit of a screw-up as a teenager and a young man, but got interested in being a writer. And he, pretty early on, developed a style, as you said in your introduction, he called it gonzo journalism. Sometimes people call it new journalism, where he often inserted himself, his own personality, into his political writing, and often inserted a kind of, like, caricature of himself as a kind of drug-addled, speed-freaky, wild guy. And he did that, and that's usually what people think of when they think of Hunter S. Thompson. They think of this kind of caricature of the drug age. But he did that. He adopted gonzo journalism for a really serious reason, which is that he thought most political journalists, most political reporters, are too clubby. They're too connected to the politicians they're trying to cover, quote unquote, objectively. And a lot of times they get to be friends with the very people who they're, you know, ostensibly reporting on. And so Thompson thought that too much political reporting in America has a kind of, like, clubby inside, you know, elites talking about their elite drinking buddies feel. And he really wanted to make clear to Americans that he was not that guy, that he was somebody who was outside the political establishment, that he was somebody who was going to put his opinion out there and wasn't going to hide the fact that he was putting his opinion out there. But at the same time, he was going to do serious journalistic work. When he wrote about the Hell's Angels, he literally had the Hell's Angels over for parties at his apartment, you know, freaked out everybody else in the apartment complex to no end. But he really got to know the people he was reporting on, but wasn't doing it in a way that was just cocktail parties in Washington.
And he got very close to his subjects. He was even beaten up by the Hells Angels.
Yeah, Hells Angels ends. Thompson gets a motorcycle. He rides it around with the Angels. He goes to some of their parties. And after a while, he becomes convinced. You know, when he starts out, he's thinking, these guys are never going to trust me. I'm a reporter. Most reporters have just pilloried the Angels, and but he spends some time with them. But it doesn't take too long for the Angels to decide ultimately that he's a bit suspicious, just because he is a journalist. And Hell's Angels ends more or less when a bunch of the Angels beat him up, and that's what worries Thompson about the Angels in the end. Is that he worries that they have so. They've given up so much on the possibility that anything in the, you know, they've given up on the system so much that when it comes down to it, they're just going to resort to violence.
Which brings us to media, who are in often considered the elite class, and liberal media and elite class. And has that led to distrust in Thompson's era and today?
Mm-hmm. Thompson is somebody who was really attuned. You know, today everybody's talking about mainstream media and liberal media and elite media. Thompson was really worried 50 years ago about all of those things. And so he was an interesting person. He was a journalist who was in some ways trying to rescue journalism for the American people, to be the kind of journalist. And he did it in this kind of bizarre, performative way. To just try to show people that there were different possibilities for journalism. And I think to try to make Americans savvier consumers of journalism.
One thing that is unclear to me is why would the motorcycle guys that you write about, that Thompson followed, and the motorcycle guys of today really back Trump? Because, here President Trump, who has inherited immense wealth, mm-hmm. has hundreds of business interests around the world, and lives a life worlds away from these quote-unquote motorcycle guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that Thompson saw in the motorcycle guys is that they loved the show. They loved performing a kind of stick up your middle finger at the whole system. And one of the things that Trump does have in common with the motorcycle guys is that Trump is also really good at performing stick up your middle finger to the whole system. Trump embraces his political incorrectness, which is something that, you know, that language didn't exist when Thompson was writing about the Hell's Angels. But those guys also loved tweaking elites by saying things that were not polite or that pushed on the boundaries of what was acceptable. And so I think a lot of people respond to in Donald Trump is Trump's willingness to say things that aren't safe, that are impolite, that are even crude or crass. That I think for a lot of people trumps, for lack of a better word, some of his actual, say, business interests, social standing, and so on and so forth.
We're talking with political science professor Susan McWilliams about how author Hunter S. Thompson foreshadowed the reality of our politics and democracy today. McWilliams points to his book Hell's Angels for having keen insights into a society segmented by class. You can join in this discussion at 800-486-8655. What do you think about using literature to help us understand our political climate today? Do you have questions for Susan about the parallels she's drawing to the Trump administration? Add your voice to the discussion at 800-486-8655. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. And when we come back, we'll explore some of the politics as well of 1984 and why readers are flocking to it. This is the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation with political scientist Susan McWilliams. In recent days, we've been learning about the latest data dump of CIA spy material by WikiLeaks and the ways the agency can hack into phones, computers, and TVs connected to the internet. But almost 70 years ago, well before Americans were online, George Orwell created a dystopian world with some provocatively similar elements in his novel 1984. And in the mid-60s, author Hunter S. Thompson wrote about motorcycle guys in his book Hell's Angels that gives us insights on the divided America today. And you can join in this discussion at 800-486-8655. What do you think are the lessons we should take away from the writing of Thompson, the writing of Orwell? Are you looking for insights from long ago on the age of politics we are in today? And what do you want to ask Susan about this? Join in at 800-486-8655 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's take a call now. Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I remember reading Hunter S. Thompson's book in high school. And, you know, this whole idea of these guys being masculine and all that, they were thugs. They were criminals. They murdered people. They had initiation rites where they raped women and passed them around their women. And I think if you're going to look for some sort of correlation between that kind of crude behavior, that I think I find nothing honorable in that, nothing masculine in that. Nothing in the way that I understand the term masculine, certainly not in any correlation to the men who fought fascism in World War II or anything like that, or any sort of patriotism. And the thing they have in common with Trump is their degrading attitude toward women and their, you know, if that's politically incorrect to be crude and indecent, then I don't think that bodes very well for our future or for Trump. And I think Hunter S. Thompson, he sort of, I remember reading it and thinking that he kind of liked these guys, he kind of admired these guys, but then they kind of turned on him because they were criminals, thugs. They were not good people.
Susan?
Mm-hmm. I think Thompson would agree with you. The very end of the book ends with, he's quoting Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and the last words of Hell's Angels are, the horror, exterminate all the brutes. Thompson does, I think, flirt with liking these guys in part because he really does believe that we as Americans, or Americans of his time, had an obligation to try to figure out why those motorcycle gangs existed, what they were doing, what, you know, like how they emerged in the first place. And I think he spends a lot of time trying to understand them, and at the end he is horrified by how violent they are. And that's what he says in some ways about their politics, that when it comes down to it, they're not interested in hope or changing the system or anything like that. They're really more interested in destruction. And I don't want to say, I don't want to be taken to say that, you know, today all Trump supporters are hell-bent on destruction. I don't think that's the case. But I do think there's a kind of undercurrent in a lot of what gets called Trumpism of, you know, drain the swamp, destroy it all. And that's a kind of, while not totally identical to what's going on with the Hells Angels, it's certainly part of a continuity.
Well, Willem, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Ken in Wapaka. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Say, I just had a quick question or a comment about Hunter S. Thompson's The Generation of Swine. I was just reading that, and I thought that was kind of interesting, some of his thoughts about the 80s and just about politics and some of the, you know, the media and the politics, the whole thing, and I thought it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what her thoughts were about that.
Well, I think, you know, I'll be the first to say I think that Thompson may well be, if not, you know, the smartest, then certainly one of the smartest political writers of our time, and I mean our time today, but I also mean in general the last 50 years of American politics. I don't think he got much wrong, and I think he said a lot of things that I think he figured out a lot of things first, and I think he is you know, pretty good at seeing through to the heart of the 1980s, just as he was in, you know, earlier years.
Yeah, it seems like he, Yeah, he just saw through. He definitely saw into the future. I think he had an interesting perspective. Thanks, and thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thank you.
Yep, bye-bye.
Yeah, Ken, thank you. And Susan, what might Thompson say about fake news today?
Well, I think that, Thompson would say that, like I said, he was always worried. He was always worried about journalism. He was worried about the clubbiness of most, of mainstream journalists. And so, though I think that he would be worried about, that whole idea that there's fake news, I think he thought a lot of times journalists were, would protect friends that they knew. I think a lot of times he thought that journalists gave us only the partial story. But I think, he as a journalist would be concerned any time that, in a situation like we have today where some people are saying basically you can't trust any journalism.
Mm-hmm. And we were looking for a clip of him in an interview earlier today, and we found one that he was talking more so about conspiracy theories. And this is a short clip from his interview with Australia's ABC Radio National. It is on the one-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The interviewers asked Thompson about how he thought the U.S. media had performed in the new post-9/11 reality. Let's take a listen.
Yeah, to just assume that when first it was Osama bin Laden, and then it was Saddam Hussein, it may be that the secret police and the great intelligence operations of America are so much smarter than we are and know so much more than we are and are so much more responsible and effective than we are.
So what is he getting at there in this interview, that he thinks that there is a larger network going on of surveillance?
Well, one of the things that Thompson said, and he said it starting, I think, in the early 1970s, he said, look, politics is a complicated thing. And politics, he said, is politics has its own language. He said it's often so complex that it borders on being a code. And there are lots of things going on that if you're not paying attention or if you're only casually paying attention, you're going to miss. There are complicated institutions and of power in the United States and beyond it, and one has to be aware of that. I think that Americans are aware of that. Think about the WikiLeaks dump this week. People know that there are these big organizations out there that have lots of information, but we don't know what that information is. I think one of the things that Thompson consistently did was to try to remind Americans of that. It seems maybe a little more apparent to us now, but he was one of the first people, I think, calling our attention to that phenomenon.
And we're talking with Susan McWilliams. She's an associate professor of politics at Pomona College in California. Her recent article in The Nation is titled, "This Political Theorist Predicted the Rise of Trumpism." His name was Hunter S. Thompson. We have a link over to it on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can join in the discussion at 800-486-8655. Have you read Hell's Angels? What do you think about using literature to help understand the political climate we live in today? Join in the discussion at 800-486-8655. What would happen today, do you think, if we could imagine Hunter S. Thompson sitting down to have a conversation with President Trump, President Putin? I mean, what might this look like?
That's pretty funny to imagine, for so many reasons. Well, one thing they might do is talk motorcycles. I'm sure that Hunter S. Thompson would have picked up on what maybe some of your listeners picked up on, which is that Trump talks about motorcycles a lot. He talked about them on the campaign trail. He talked about them. He talked about Harley Davidson in particular in his first address to a joint session of Congress. And when Trump talks about motorcycles and Harleys in particular, he's always in some ways using them as a way to try to get a certain kind of political currency. I mean, it's not like Trump rides motorcycles. In fact, he said quite explicitly, I don't ride bikes. The limos are more my style. and I think that Thompson would have a hard time resisting the urge to talk motorcycles with Donald Trump. I think Thompson would have seen the ways in which I think Trump in some ways uses motorcycle, that imagery kind of cynically to appeal to people who are motorcycle riders and who like what motorcycles stand for or what mean to them. I imagine they would have at least talked about that, but probably many more things, too.
Let's take another call now. Bill in Superior. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, I just want to say, many years ago, I think it was like 1987 or so, I had a chance to have a bunch of drinks with Hunter S. Thompson at the Fine Line Cafe in Minneapolis, and that was quite an experience. I had my motorcycle parked out front. I'd given my friend a ride there. She was singing at the Fine Line that night, and we got to hang out for the whole evening, kind of real low key, you know.
What did you talk about?
Well, we talked about this and that, like my bike. And then writing and this and that. And then I brought up the angel thing from many years ago, and he really didn't want to talk about that too much. Because from what I understand, that ended badly for him.
Yeah. Does that surprise you, Susan?
No, I think it did end badly for him. I think some of the interviews he did after he spent time with the angels, he said, basically something to the effect of, these guys proved, and this is what the first caller said, to be pretty bad guys. And I realize that in the future, we're going to be up against some pretty mean guys, and I'm going to try to be nicer. That's what he said. I've realized that I need to try to be a bit nicer, that's in some ways a kind of political act for him. But, in any case, yeah, I think it was a difficult ending for him. He tried really hard to understand them, and in the end, they beat him up.
Why did he want to write Hell's Angels in the first place?
This is a bit of a family story. And how I got interested in Hunter S. Thompson, in some ways, my grandfather, Kerry McWilliams, was the editor of The Nation magazine for many years. And he prided himself on seeking out new talent. And he, at some point, I don't know how exactly he found Hunter S. Thompson, but asked him if he would investigate the phenomenon of motorcycle gangs in California. And Thompson liked the idea right away, the cycle idea, he called it, and said, there's something really big about our society here. I can sense it. If only I can get close enough to these guys to figure out what it is.
Well, Bill, thanks for your call and your personal story. Very interesting. Let's now go to Daryl in Cotteray. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. I was calling to disagree with the professor on her definition of politics. Mine is only seven words. Politics equals feelings because feelings equal politics. It's the truest truth there is. Everything else is business as usual.
What do you mean by that, politics is feelings?
Okay, when you go to vote, you get out of bed because you feel like it. Then you go to the voting booth because you feel like it. Mm-hmm. And then you vote for somebody because you feel like that for whatever reason. Maybe it's the color of their hair. But everything is all about feeling. And to not see it that way, I really can't understand politics any other way. Everything else is business as usual.
Right. Well, I do think, I don't agree with you. I don't think Thompson would disagree with you. I think he thought that the Hell's Angels represented a particular kind of political feeling. He called it total retaliation. I tend to call it pissed off. And I think you're absolutely right. At that level of individual voters in particular, yes. I mean, in fact, there's all sorts of proof, quote unquote, in political science that people vote with their hearts, not necessarily with lots of rational calculation. I do think that Thompson would draw attention, though, to the fact that there are real institutions in place. They're big. They're powerful. They control a lot of the terms of our existence. In fact, they can manipulate how we feel about things. And maybe that's where...
Visual.
Orwell comes in. I know that Kate mentioned a few minutes ago.
Yeah, that's the toward the direction we're going. Yeah. Daryl, do you have anything else to add?
I wish it wasn't this way. I wish people could get in touch with their feelings and talk about their feelings. Then we could get down to a real American politics.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really well said. And in some ways, I think that's what Thompson's hope was. You know, he wanted to take away a lot of the pretensions out of politics so that we could actually talk about what was going on with us.
For instance, do you ever notice when you ask people their ethnicity, they'll say, I'm Jewish American or African American or something like that? Well, that's okay if they're immigrants. But if you're born here, aren't you an American Jewish person or an American German person? The only ones that get it right are the Native Americans. But if you think about it, anybody born and raised in this country is a Native American.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much for your call. And Susan, let us pivot here before we go to break for a moment. Much has been made about the spike in the copies sold of 1984, George Orwell's 1984, and publishers couldn't keep up with demand a few months ago. Media loved reporting on this. There was a bit of a feeding frenzy. Why are readers hungry to read 1984 right now?
Well, I think that Orwell, and this is in 1984 and in other things he wrote a great essay called Politics in the English Language. Orwell was somebody who, long before we were talking about alternative facts or fake news, he was somebody who understood exactly how important language is to politics and who understood really well how easy it is for all of us to be manipulated through language, politically manipulated, and how easy it was for people to manipulate others through language. And with all that kind of conversation going on now, it seems to me almost inevitable that people would turn to Orwell. Orwell understood something that it's really important for all of us to understand when we're thinking about politics, which is that if people hear something often enough, whether or not it's true, people will start to believe that it's true. Like, the classic example might be, if you tell a kid she's special and smart every day of her life, she'll grow up believing that she's special and smart. But if you tell a kid every day growing up, you know, I wish you were never born, you're a waste, kid'll grow up believing that they're a waste. And just as that's true for raising kids, it's true for all of us. If we hear things over and over and over again, whether or not they're true, we will start to believe them. And every, you know, propagandistic, totalitarian, authoritarian regime has used language to manipulate people. And so, you know, whether we're talking about today's political moment or any other political moment, I think we as individuals always have to be on guard against the fact that it's not that hard for us to be manipulated. So I see in the sales of 1984 a lot of worry among Americans, I think, across the political spectrum, that we could be manipulated, that maybe we are being manipulated, that it's hard to get a handle on what's true and what's not. And there really isn't a better work that I know than 1984 that reminds us how true that is.
Yeah. And what are some of these interesting similarities that we can draw to our world we live in today? Because, you know, as a casual reader, we're reading into things like a data dump and we're thinking of Orwell. We're looking at so many different aspects of this book and just really and maybe we don't have our scientific hats on in realizing that Orwell was a very, very different dystopian world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that Orwell is exploring some things that are so familiar to us, just the existence of technology that we use every day, but that none of us fully understand. I mean, all of us probably know how to use a smartphone, but who among us knows what really is inside there, really how it works, really what it could do? The, you know, CIA leaks of this week, I think, just remind us of what we all know to be true all the time but tend not to talk about, which is that there are technological powers all around us that are part of our everyday lives that we can't control and that can be used to control us. And so I don't think the dystopia of 1984 needs to be exactly like our lives today for it to be raising those sorts of questions. How do we as humans preserve our humanity, preserve our freedom, preserve our individuality in a kind of really overwhelming technological context?
Let's take a call now. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I'm really glad you brought up 1984. I'm a person who doesn't use the internet, and
good for you.
Reading the book 1984 back in the 90s, I guess, is when I first read it, and then I saw the English version, and then later the American version. The English version movie of that is very disturbing. It's in some ways it's hard to watch, but I wondered. I work in a union, and I work with a lot of progressive people. And through Obama's term, after we had just dealt with George Bush, who I thought was extremely Orwellian, I voted for Obama twice, but I really began to think and feel that our inner feelings that so many people are putting into their Facebook pages, into their tweets and everything, that's really not a good idea to put that out there into this vast network that siphons all this and eventually categorizes it. Like, for instance, now Trump is our president, and all the progressives that have been writing like crazy online, I wouldn't be surprised if in the NSA there's different categories, like this could be a violent liberal, and this we're going to line these people up in this category, and these are violent, maybe right-wingers, and they'll go into a second category. And we kind of had an echo of that in Egypt after the Arab Spring. The military government took over again, and then they went to people's Facebook pages and Twitter pages and started rounding up people and arresting them, and I think a lot of them are still in jail there for what they thought was freedom of expression, and let's, you know, put this out on a billboard. And then the final statement I wanted to say was, isn't it ironic and Orwellian that the first book taken off of these e-reading, you know, sites, I don't know the name of the different companies that have the e-books, but the first book to be taken off without your permission, people had bought versions of 1984, it was on their e-readers, and all on the same day, this was a couple years ago, all of the 1984 e-reading stuff disappeared from their electronic media because the original company had not straightened out the copyright rights to put the book into e-form. So without asking anybody, people woke up in the morning and their e-readers did not have the book 1984 in it anymore. And isn't that a strange feedback loop?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's all really interesting. I think one way to understand the present political moment is that we are in a time of emerging technological disillusionment. And what I mean by that is I remember almost 20 years ago going to a conversation at a place in New York City. It was about the future of democracy and the internet. And every single one of the very fancy, you know, smart political commentators said, you know, well, I think at the time we all believed, and we're talking about up to and through the Arab Spring, the internet is going to be a boon for democracy. The people are going to take back control. Corporations are going to lose power. This is going to be a moment of democratic flourishing. And if you look at where we are almost 20 years later, you know, I told my young millennial students that a couple months ago, and they laughed in my face. That seemed to them the most naive idea of all time. I mean, 20 years ago, you know, with 20 years knowledge, what we see is, in fact, that, you know, the people who, you know, people in power tend to have more power. You know, the power players have shifted a little bit, but people feel under surveillance, under threat. These tools that were supposed to be liberating for the individual can also be used, maybe or even more effectively used, as tools of surveillance. And I think that you see echoes of that in all sorts of movements in American politics at the moment, as we come to terms with the fact that all of this new technology, no matter how convenient it might be in some regards, is also maybe not what we had hoped or wished or thought it would be.
We're talking with Susan McWilliams. She's an associate professor of politics at Pomona College in California. We're discussing how the maverick journalist Hunter S. Thompson had glimpses into the future through his writings in Hell's Angels, in his book Hell's Angels, and how novelist George Orwell has some amazing glimpses a bit of what we're seeing today with CIA data dumps and so forth from 1984. What do you think? You can join the discussion, 800-486-8655, or post your thoughts on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with politics professor Susan McWilliams. She teaches at Pomona College, and her recent article in The Nation talks about how the late maverick journalist Hunter S. Thompson really got to the heart of issues we're seeing today with the political trajectory of Donald Trump and the forces that helped him reach the White House. And you can join the discussion at 800-486-8655. Do you have a question for Susan about the themes she picks up in either 1984, as we've been discussing with Orwell, or Thompson's writing, and specifically his book, Hell's Angels? Add your voice to the conversation at 800-486-8655. Let's go to David now in Oshkosh. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question here. I was having a discussion with somebody about 1984 the other day, and they raised an interesting point to me, and I haven't really come down on this one yet. But I always took it as kind of a cautionary tale of the rise of Big Brother and government. They explained it as a cautionary tale of the rise of the corporation. Or is it that because of cronyism, they're kind of one and the same now today? And I do just want to say for all the listeners out there, if you have a chance, look at this WikiLeaks dump. Vault 7, it's out there. It's available for everybody. The things that are expressed in there are shocking. Obviously, everyone knows our phones and tablets can be hacked, our laptops, our computers easily, but our televisions aren't safe. They can spy on us and turn the cameras on remotely without you ever even knowing. I mean, it shows exactly how the CIA had the capabilities to mock a hack from other countries like Russia, which, I mean, we all know what's going on there. It raises a lot of good questions, and the information is out there for people to see it, and I think it's very, very important that they do.
John, thank you so much for your call. And Susan, what can we glean from 1984 and all of these other books from so many decades ago that can inform our world today?
Well, I'm to the question that David asked first, I do think that when Orwell was writing 1984, he, like many people of his time, was particularly concerned about the possibility of emerging totalitarian governmental power. But I think that, I can't remember if it was you or your friend who were talking about corporations, but whoever said that I think is also right. I think for the reasons you said, today governmental power is inextricably bound up with certain kinds of corporate power. Even our military is, you know, not insubstantially outsourced to private corporations. And so for Americans of today, I think when you're doing something like reading 1984, it should resonate on the levels both of worries about extraordinary governmental power, but also extraordinary corporate power. You know, as to the larger question about looking at all of these books that have been written 50 or 70 years ago, resonating today, I think that one of the things that I for one like about reading books that were written just a little bit outside the present political moment is that you know that nobody who wrote them is being paid off or trying to spin or trying to get advantage in the contemporary political environment. And in that way, in some ways, they feel more trustworthy to me. Hunter S. Thompson died 12 years ago. He's not trying to get political advantage in this moment. But it's also, I mean, the other good thing I think about reading books that are a little bit older that resonate with our contemporary political moment is that they remind us that things that we think of as totally new or totally unprecedented are not usually totally new or totally unprecedented. A lot of times, and I talked about this when I wrote about Thompson in The Nation, things that we think of as new political phenomenon have been building for a long time. And in looking at how they've been building over time, looking at where they come from, we can understand them better and not have that sense of terror that comes with believing that we're confronting something that's never been confronted before in human history.
Well, thanks so much for your call, John. Let's go now to Maurice in Madison. Hi, Maurice.
Hi. I just thought I'd add a tidbit from my own experience. When I was in the Army it was 1970, I knew a Hell's Angel. He was from Monterey. He was a National Guardsman who had been activated. And you're right. It's mainly testosterone-driven. He was pretty apolitical. The only thing political they were interested in was the helmet law in California. But the guy was unbelievably violent. Mm-hmm. There was another biker in our unit, the Outlaws from Detroit. And they got in a fight one night. The Outlaw actually won. But anyway, you're right that NRS Thompson, I can't remember what he said about them, but they were Okies. They were from the Central Valley, mainly, of California. And their parents had come over in the 30s in that, you know, the Grapes of Wrath kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And these were the children of these people, mainly. That's where their main stock came from. And I think Hunter Thompson even said that.
Mm-hmm. Well, even if they were apolitical in a lot of ways, one of the things that your comment reminds me of, as Thompson says, there's one way in which these guys really had a clear political stance that wasn't a screw-the-system stance, and that is that they supported the military.
Yeah.
In fact, there's near the end of Hell's Angels, the Angels just freak out all the Berkeley types because they march with the John Birch Society on behalf of the Vietnam War. They even write to President Lyndon Baines Johnson and offer their services to go fight the war in Vietnam. And so I think to the extent that Trump wants to appeal to that kind of, you know, that kind of demographic today, it makes sense that Trump is asking for a lot more money from the military. The military and the police are almost oddly, given the fact that the Hell's Angels were often being locked up, they were the political forces that the Angels respected the most.
Maurice, thank you so much for your call. And as we wrap up here, Susan, as a political scientist, guide us on some of these books and some of these authors from decades ago who could help give us some sense, perhaps, of what politics is like today. And, of course, you are focused here on Hunter S. Thompson. We've talked about 1984. Are there other books that you have read that you really find some real similarities to what the politics of the landscape is today?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the classics in American political literature is Robert Penn Warren's book, All the King's Men, which is about a really charismatic political leader who fights against corruption, but, you know, it won't spoil the book to tell you, ultimately ends up becoming corrupt himself. And thinking about how that happens, why that might happen, is important for all of us to be able to do. I also think that the writings of James Baldwin are particularly resonant in the present day. He's somebody who is famous for talking about race in American politics, but he does a fabulous job of talking about inequality and the many kinds of inequality, the political inequality, the economic inequality that we see in American politics at the present moment. But there are lots of other examples, and I would encourage your listeners in general to just remember that often some of the most interesting things that are being said in politics and about politics have always been written by writers of fiction and writers of serious nonfiction, writers of books. A lot of times you can say things in books about politics that no newspaper would print. And that's something that Thompson knew for sure. He wrote for Rolling Stone, and Rolling Stone let him say things that, you know, he couldn't say in traditional newspapers. And so there's lots of political wisdom to be found in books where Americans maybe don't tend to look for political insight.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Susan McWilliams is an associate professor of politics at Pomona College. Her recent article in The Nation is titled, Political Theorists Predicted Rise of Trumpism. His name was Hunter S. Thompson. You can find a link to her article, and we can continue the discussion over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Monday means all things political here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll talk about the latest political news with USA Today columnist Jill Lawrence. That's Monday at 1 o'clock right here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us after the news. The internet and social media, as it grows ever more sophisticated and targeted, threatens democracy by creating echo chambers and information cocoons. That's according to a Harvard professor of behavioral economics who offers practical solutions to help unite our country. Thanks to Colleen Duvall for producing this show and for on-air production help today. We had technical direction from Lisa Nalbandian. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for the Kathleen Dunn Show here on the Ideas Network.